Thank you. We're going to call the Tax Committee to order. We don't have a quorum yet. Members, we're going to take Representative Davids now moves House File 318, I believe it is. Representative Davids? Is that right? Is that the right number?
Yes, Madam Chair, 318. Yep.
318. And members, Representative Davids and I were just talking about his bill, and Representative Detmer slipped me a cupcake. So it's Representative Detmer's birthday tomorrow and his wife's birthday tomorrow, which I think is why he married her, but he claims he didn't know that. So anyway, he and his wife have their same birthday tomorrow. Representative Davids, please.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'll move House File 318, eventually be laid over for possible inclusion in omnibus bill. Members, what this bill does is this is federal conformity. It increases standard deduction for married filers, and this is tax year 13 and beyond. There's an increased income phase out for the working family credit and increased Section 179 expensing amounts. If you look at the bill, there's a whole lot of other stuff in there that our chair was so gracious to carry through and have signed into Law House File 6. So basically, those are the three things we're looking at. And maybe if, Madam Chair, if Ms. Manzi could kind of give a little better description of what each of those does.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, you know, I just want to say, Representative Davids and I were just talking about this. The House has always understood why conformity is important. It's been very bipartisan. The former chair has pushed it, this one, back and forth, and it really is important, and members often don't understand that. And I think Ms. Manzi should also, you know, we should all recognize how hard Ms. Manzi works to make sure we're all on board with that. So, Ms. Manzi, if you can hit the highlights for us, for Representative Davids.
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, and members of the committee, the bill that was already enacted this year, House File 6, which became Chapter 3, only addressed the federal law that was enacted in January with respect to tax year 12, for which people are now filing their returns. That federal law made a lot of changes that were permanent, that have become permanent parts of the Federal Internal Revenue Code, and it also extended numerous provisions to tax year 13, after which they will expire and they'll have to go through this exercise again. Representative Davids, House File 318 with the A4 amendment would update to the items in the January federal tax law for tax year 2013 and beyond. So it includes the three items that Representative Davids mentioned, which are some of the bigger items on the revenue estimate, the increase in the married joint standard deduction to be twice the size of the single standard deduction, which was made a permanent feature of the federal tax law in the January bill, the increased Section 179 expensing amounts, which the federal law extended only for tax years 12 and 13. So House File 6 did not conform to those for tax year 12. House File 318 would conform to those increased expensing amounts for tax year 13. After tax year 13, then the increased federal amounts drop down to their old level unless, of course, they're extended again. And then the other item that Representative Davids mentioned was the increase in the phase-out threshold for married filers under the federal earned income credit. And his bill contains increases in the phase-out threshold for the state's companion credit to the earned income credit, which is the working family credit. The federal law increased those phase-out thresholds by $5,000 for married joint filers for tax years 12 through 17, and then by $3,000 for married joint filers for tax year 18 and beyond. And House File 318 with the A4 amendment would match those increases. Now, those $5,000 and $3,000 amounts aren't really what it would be, because those both would be indexed for inflation from base years of either 2008 or 2009. But this would, his bill would conform to that on an ongoing basis. In addition, if you look at either the estimate or the summary, there are numerous other provisions, many of them related to special categories of expensing and depreciation that were extended either to tax year 13 or made permanent. And House File 318 would conform on all of those items. Many of those items we discussed in the hearings on House File 6, and unless you'd like me to go through them one by one, I think I'll skip that, Madam Chair. Representative Davids
shaking his head no, but Representative Davids, we have quorum, so Did you want to move your A4?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move House File 318. Madam Chair, I'll move the A4 amendment, which has the bill's been described as if that was already in there.
Discussion to the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed say nay. The A4 is adopted. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I think basically that's it, unless there's any questions. Also, while I have the mic for just a second, I think it was last week where I talked to the department, I think it was Ms. Von Mosch, regarding the estate tax issue, and was quite concerned about that, expressed some concern. I would just like to report that the department has met with the Farm Bureau and the Farmers Union on the estate tax issues, and they put some language together that I think is very favorable for the small business folks and the farmers. So I just wanted to give an update on that, that the department did work with those two groups, and they've got a bill put together that I think is very satisfactory. So I thank the department for that. So basically, we have House File 318 as amended. Madam Chair, I'd stand for any questions.
Is there anyone who wants to testify for or against this bill? And Representative Davids and I are talking. I have asked the staff, actually, they've helped me. You know, this frustration we've had in the House with the Senate, I guess we're not really supposed to say that, but the House really has tried to do this dues conformity, and we always have this problem of how do we pay for it. And, you know, conformity is really just tax cuts for people and convenience in a timely fashion. And so one concept that's been done is to just adjust the brackets to pay for it, so you don't have to always go do battle with the other body to come to resolution, and people can sort of automatically get their tax relief. That's one option. Ms. Manzi and Mr. Michael have come up with another option as well, and I just want to offer them as amendments, and then I talk to Representative Davids if this is all right, withdraw them, just so we can all hear what they are and think about them, because at the end of the day in the omnibus tax bill, you know, I think the two of us would like to do conformity. We can see the revenue estimate makes it a hefty price tag, but our taxpayers are waiting. So if that's all right with you, Representative Davids, I'm just going to have Ms. Manzi go through them.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And so if we can get both of those amendments passed out, I have not even seen them, but maybe Ms. Manzi can start talking about one of them, the concept. I don't think the language will really mean much to us as we look at it. So Ms. Manzi.
Madam Chair, I don't know if the pages also have the one-page descriptions of the amendments, which they passed those out at the same time.
Yeah, we should get that one page is the top priority. Yes, if you can pass it out at the same time, because the language is more esoteric, citing federal tax law.
All right, Madam Chair, first I think I'll discuss the A6 amendment. There are two of them, the A6 and the A7. At one point we had the A5 and it fell by the wayside. The A6 does what Chair Lincheski described. The A6 is essentially the same as Representative David's A4 amendment with two differences. And the first difference is that it would not conform to the increased Section 179 expensing amounts for tax year 2013. So that brings down the cost of the bill. If you look at the, I guess first of all, if you look at the revenue estimate for House File 318 with the A4 amendment, you see that it's got a rather large price tag. It's
Ms. Manzi, I'm going to interrupt folks. Does everyone have what we're looking at here? Okay, it's in your packet. This is Representative David's revenue estimate as he just amended his bill. Okay, so Ms. Manzi is going to talk about kind of a subversion off this one pager to see if we can figure out how to stop having our taxpayers wait for conformity. And if it's not going to be acceptable, I understand. I don't really know how they work either, but just an option here. So you kind of have to look at these two sheets. Ms. Manzi.
Hey, Madam Chair. So the revenue estimate you see has a impact of $15.1 million in fiscal 13, $189.3 million in fiscal year 14, and $83.2 million in fiscal 15. So it's quite a large revenue impact in this biennium. And this has always been an issue in dealing with federal conformity. It tends to be items that the federal government has chosen to do. And then if Minnesota wants to make the tax filing system simpler for their taxpayers, well, here it is. You get to, you know, have a couple $100 million of expenditures in this biennium, and you didn't get to pick which ones they were going to be. They were chosen by the federal government. So Representative Lincheski asked us to come up with a way to make this sort of more automatic and less difficult from the money standpoint, and that is what the A6 amendment attempts to accomplish with respect to this particular federal law. So the A6 amendment does not do the Section 179 expensing, and then it contains a couple of sections that adjust the individual income tax brackets. Those are on, let's see, those would be Sections 7 and 8 under the amendment. They're on pages 3 and 4 of the bill. Now, when you look at the language of the bill, that's a little deceptive, because the bracket amounts that are in statute are the brackets as they were set, in tax year 2000, which is the last time that the individual income tax rates were changed. So the dollar amounts that appear in statute are not the dollar amounts that are actually in effect for tax year 13, because those are adjusted annually for inflation. And that's what the next section of statute does. And that section of statute also appears in the A6 amendment as Section 8. So if you have, at this point, the one-page handout, that shows you in a table near the middle of the page what the couple of tables, what those thresholds really are in tax year 13 under current law and what they would be under the A6 amendment. So if you look at that first table, the 7.05% rate under current law begins to apply when taxable income reaches $35,481 for a married couple filing jointly. So the income over the $35,480 and then up to the threshold for the next bracket, which appears in the second table, is taxed at a rate of 7.05%. What the A6 amendment does is it lowers that threshold at which the rate changes from 5.35% to 7.05%, from $35,481 to $31,841, to pick up additional revenue at the 7.05% rate. And then it does the same thing with the threshold for the 7.85% bracket. So that would decrease from $140,960 to $118,120. The final column of those tables shows you the maximum additional tax that a filer affected by those bracket changes would pay. So a married couple filing jointly who had taxable income of $140,960 or higher would pay a total increase of first the $67 that would be at 7.05% instead of being at 5.35%, and then $183 that would be at 7.85% instead of being at 7.05%. If you had more than $140,960, you wouldn't pay any more because all of your income over that amount is already at the 7.85%. And you can go through the same calculations for the single filers and the head of household filers. There is an estimate, and I don't know if that's if the pages have that or it's been distributed.
Ms. Manzi, I don't know that we need to get into the detailed estimate. Okay. It's more the concepts, I think, for members to understand what's going on here. Some people will view these in tax increases or cuts, but just kind of what are the two concepts? So
sure.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I only mentioned the estimate because that would show that when you take these new brackets and you apply them and you do it together with House File 318, then these changes in the brackets offset the revenue lost through federal conformity. And it doesn't do it on a each fiscal year basis, but over the course of the budget period, it nets out. And that's because when you look at the estimate for the bill with the A4 amendment, you see that it's sort of an uneven pattern in when the revenue impacts occur. So that's the intent, that's the concept, is for the bracket changes to offset the revenue impact of the federal conformity, okay. And that is what the A6 does. Okay. Now, the way that I adjusted the brackets was to try to put the revenue gain from the bracket changes into the brackets that would receive the benefits of the federal conformity items, and I went through those and sort of tried to do a ballpark of where those would fall, and it comes out that about two-thirds of the revenue gain would fall on the lowering of the threshold for the 7.05% bracket, and then one-third would fall on the lowering of the threshold for the 7.85% bracket.
Okay. So I'm going to move the A6. We're considering it now. I intend to withdraw it, okay, but just so people can think about this a little bit. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could, I would like to respectfully correct Ms. Manzi on one point where she said that the numbers for 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 were quite large. I'm trying to get this thing passed, so I'm going to consider them a rounding error.
Thank you. And I don't think we have these revenue estimates that mm-hmm. you're referencing, so mm-hmm. Maybe we had a miscommunication. But I guess before we could jump to the A7, the way I'm thinking about the A6, if you look at the A6, it looks like a tax increase, right? I mean, everyone sees that. You know, if you make 35 and you are going to get an additional tax of $67 by doing this, but you're paying for your tax cut. Okay, so it's supposed to be revenue neutral, and you're not always trying to find the money. And we've seen bipartisanly everybody can't come up with how we're going to get the standard deduction done. So I think, is that a fair analysis of kind of what I'm trying to do here? I think both parties can game this. The rhetoric is certainly there if people want to use it. That's a built-in tax increase, or that's a built-in tax cut. And that's the point. They're supposed to cancel each other out. Representative Davids?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just so I have a clear, the sheet shows that it's up $67 and up $183 on married joint. But I'm kind of confused here. Where are we finding that we have a lowering of the tax burden because of the conformity?
Your bill.
The
tax
bill itself.
Cuts. It would pay for your bill.
Madam Chair and Ms. Manzi, where are those numbers? Because we want to offset the increase showing the decrease.
Representative Davids,
trying to sell this thing.
Yeah, no, and I, you know, maybe we don't want to do this, but Representative Davids, that's exactly right. I think that's the revenue estimate she's looking for that we don't have. Ms. Manzi.
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, I don't think that's exactly the revenue estimate. I think what you're asking for is something I can attempt to provide you with, but I don't have it right now. But I think what you're asking for is some information on how much of the total tax increase under the bracket changes is borne by filers at different income ranges. So an income distribution of the tax increase, and then an income distribution of the tax decrease under the conformity items, such as the married standard deduction and so forth. And that I do not have, but I can prepare something like that for some of the major conformity items. Many of the smaller conformity items, we simply don't have the data on, for instance, where some of the accelerated depreciation items fall across the income distribution and so on. But I can certainly do that for the married joint standard deduction and the working family credit item. The standard deduction tends to fall more on, I guess I'll say, income levels below $100,000. At higher income levels, filers are more likely to claim itemized deductions, so they're not going to benefit from that. Now, so these tax increases in the table sort of suggest that the higher income groups would have a larger tax increase, and that's true as individuals, but there are fewer people at the higher income levels than there are at the lower income levels. So there would be a lot more people who would be paying the $67 than would be paying the $183. And I think when I worked out these brackets, it worked out so that about two-thirds of the total revenue gain was coming from the lower group and one-third from the upper group. So I can certainly work up that information and provide it to you.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll talk to Ms. Manzi offline on that because I think you're right when you talk about the standard deduction, phase-out work and family credit, and the increased Section 179 just depends on what somebody's doing. I mean, if they're right. going to be able to exercise that. So.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, Representative Davids, Representative Lincheski's amendment does not include the Section 179, so that wasn't an issue in setting the brackets here.
Okay.
So I'm going to withdraw the A6. I'm going to move the A7, Ms. Manzi. And we just want to get the concept out here and finish with Representative Davids' bill so we can get to Representative Clark's bill. Ms. Manzi.
Madam Chair, the A7 amendment is more conceptual and attempts to make more of an ongoing solution to the federal conformity issue that the legislature seems to confront year after year. This bill would direct the commissioner to prepare an estimate, which they do already every time that the federal government enacted a new tax law that affected the definition of taxable income, and determine what the effect of that was on Minnesota income tax revenues. If the new federal law was determined to affect individual and corporate franchise tax revenues in an amount that was less than 1% of what those taxes raised during the course of the year, then the commissioner, and if the things that were in the federal law were extensions of items that Minnesota had conformed to in the past, so that would be, for example, things like the higher education tuition deduction or the educator classroom expense deduction or the increase in the phase-out threshold for student loan interest, or, you know, if Minnesota were to choose to conform to the married joint standard deduction, then that would be an extender item that Minnesota had adopted in the past. So if the federal government were to enact a bill after you all had adjourned your session in May, or within a couple of weeks of adjournment, so they would do something, say, in October, and they would do it for this tax year. So this October, they would enact something for tax year 13. And the commissioner made a determination that those things, that there were things in that bill that were just extenders to tax year 13, and that those things would have a revenue impact on the state of less than 1% of individual income tax and corporate franchise tax collections, then the commissioner would be directed to adjust the brackets in the manner that is done in the A6 amendments to offset that change, and to do that automatically so that they would be able to prepare the tax year 13 forms, and there wouldn't be a period of uncertainty at the start of January, February of tax year 14 as to what is Minnesota going to do with regard to these provisions. Can I file my return? Are we going to conform? Are we not going to conform? So this would only apply if those extenders had a relatively small, in the grand picture of things, effect on our revenues, and it would simplify things for taxpayers and for tax administration. I think that's the big picture. There's more details I could go into if people have questions.
Just, Representative Davids, the way I just heard the A7 and think about it is it sounds kind of to me, and I'm just wondering how the committee feels, a little bit like partially I feel halfway we're kind of giving our power to the commissioner to make that call or to follow what previous law has said. So that feels like we're giving up some authority. The flip side of that, there are extenders that the legislature has passed. And we just did kind of the A7 in that we were all working hard to get that House file of yours and mine passed pre-forecast, because the forecast just paid for that bill. That's what just happened. That $18.5 million in tax cuts, by making the deadline, governor signing it, the forecast came out, that's been paid for, and it was built in. So I hear that part of it too. So I'll withdraw the A7. Representative David's thoughts on any of these, and I know we all probably need more detail and more work.
Well, Madam Chair, I want to thank you, first of all, for coming to me before the hearing here with these ideas. I'd like to study them a lot more, but they're kind of intriguing to me, and we'll take a look at it. And I do want to thank you for your work on House File 6, because, like you said, with the forecast, now it just took care of itself. So that's a good thing, because we did it in time. So thank you, Madam Chair, for
thank you. Hearing these. Your work for the exact same bill. So questions before we go off to Representative Clark, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think these are intriguing, but I just want to make sure that I'm thinking about the differences correctly. And Ms. Manzi, if I understood you correctly, on the A6 amendment, in deciding how much to put, you know, putting two-thirds on the lower bracket and a third on the higher bracket, you said you tried to kind of, I think if I understood you right, that you tried to kind of relate it to who would get the benefit of these particular conformities. Is that correct?
Ms. Manzi.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, that's correct.
And that's one of the things that I liked about the A6 that I didn't see reflected in the A7, which is that it would be equally applied, even if the provision might more benefit the higher one, or a different provision might more affect the people in the lower bracket. And I'm wondering if we might want to think about trying to take that policy from the A6 and see if we might apply it to the A7 in some way.
Okay. Thank you for that idea. Representative Liedling? And then Representative Runbeck. Representative Liedling.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to step back a little second on all of this and just sort of ask the question, the bigger question, which I think you're raising with these amendments, which is sort of what are the costs and benefits to Minnesota of conforming? And, you know, I think there is a sort of a question that when we conform, we're kind of saying whatever Congress did, we're going to try to do that as much as we reasonably can within the bounds of our fiscal ability because of simplicity. So we're kind of letting Congress take the lead on that to set Minnesota's tax policy to a degree. And then I think, of course, the benefit that our taxpayers get from that, not only do they get some or all of the tax cuts that Congress passed, but they also get some simplicity in that. So as we get into how we might change this to make it all smoother and more automatic, in a sense, I'd like to step even back from that and say, as technology's changing and people do their taxes differently now, and I don't know the answer, but I think it would be worth really looking at how confusing is it, how necessary is conformity now when people do a lot of this online. Are there ways to make that whole thing simpler? I know that Minnesotans have an expectation that they'll be able to work closely off their federal taxes to do their state taxes. But I wonder if, and I'm kind of curious about how other states do this as well. I don't really remember hearing much about that. But I just wonder if there aren't other approaches to doing the simplicity piece for people. Because there is always, you know, I do see what you're trying to get at here, and I just wonder if we've already sort of, we've assumed that conformity is still a really necessary and important thing, and I just wonder if that's still a correct assumption.
So I don't want to take too much time on, I want to get to Representative Runbeck, but I think, Mr. Michael, if you could just comment a little bit, and members will recall when Representative Davids and I were trying to get conformity passed, I passed around the M1 form on the floor that showed everybody, you know, all the complexity that was going to happen if we didn't conform. And because we conformed, that whole form went away. Yes, there are people who are able to hire accountants who can weave through this themselves. I think there is incredible complexity still, and people having to go back and amend their taxes. But I think you're raising a really good issue. You know, do we want to just conform? We are a state that keys off the federal taxable income, and there are some states that do not, and there's plus and minuses, and that's why I'm going to ask Mr. Michael to maybe talk just for a minute about why would we conform or not, and kind of what's in it for the taxpayer.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I think, you know, it's a fairly complex issue, and there are some things that failing to conform would impose very large burdens. There are other things where it would not. And the things you need to think about are particularly timing differences, and by that I mean things that affect both business taxpayers and individual taxpayers. For business taxpayers, it would classically be things like depreciation. So if Minnesota does not conform to federal cost recovery / depreciation rules, that compels those business owners not just to sort of enter a few more numbers in their computer or their accountant doing that when they do it, but over time you have to keep records of those different allowances because it affects each year's computation of income, and when you dispose of the asset or when you transfer it, you would have to keep records of that. On the individual side, where it would present, you know, very large problems is with regard to retirement plans. There are some states, for example, Pennsylvania, I'll cite you one, that chose sort of not to follow the federal retirement plan rules because they had constitutional problems with doing that. They had a constitution that sort of prevented them. And so, for example, they didn't allow deductions when contributions were made to IRAs, and so then they want taxpayers, when they get distributions, to be able to recognize the fact that they didn't make contributions. You can just imagine what the nightmare of record keeping it is. And of course, we're all human beings, and people don't keep records. They can't find files from, you know, one day to the next, much less 30 years later after they're retired. So there are provisions like that that create very large problems. On the other hand, if it's just, you know, a K-12 teacher who's deciding, gee, do I get to take my $132 that I paid for instructional materials for my class? Sure, that's a big deal. Not a big deal. We don't conform. They just, their computer adds that back when they're doing it if they're not filing things by hand, and it's not a big deal. So it's sort of a mixed bag. It's absolutely true that the fact that we have so much better technology now makes complex taxes easier to deal with. But the other thing that's important to think about in this regard is not just the computational and compliance complexity, but it affects planning complexity. Because people make decisions based on tax law. And if you, by having the state deviate, and again it relates importantly to these sort of multi-year commitment things, if you, they're saying, oh, okay, I've got one set of rules for federal purposes and another set of rules for state purposes, suddenly their complexity of saying, should I do this or should I do that? Should I invest in this kind of investment or put my money into this kind of retirement plan versus another kind of retirement? Suddenly the degree of difficulty for that complexity has gone up. And we all know human nature is such that our world is way more complex than most of us can adequately deal with. And so that's the other thing you need to think about in making these decisions. There are other states who have had, just you mentioned about other states, there are some other states who have amended their constitutions to allow them to automatically update because their courts, like Minnesota's court, said you can't do that. We're, in this case with this A7 amendment, we think that the legislature probably can do this if it's something it's conformed to before, because then you're not really delegating power to Congress, but you're saying, hey, we've done this before and we want to continue to do it. And Congress has gotten into this mode where they're constantly enacting temporary tax laws that they constantly extend, which puts us into this sort of annual crisis mode. And this A7 is just a way to try to deal with that.
Thank you, Representative Runbeck.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just going to add, I mean, I think in terms of the planning aspect, that this affects millions of people in Minnesota, and if it is sort of a, you know, a finite group of tax deductions that we've typically taken and the feds typically offer, then it seems like it would make a lot of sense that, you know, we don't have to make these decisions over and again, and we don't have to reinvent the wheel. So it seems to make a lot of sense.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Davids, for the discussion about it, and I hope we'll just continue to work on it. Who knows if we can come to agreement, just you and I, or if we can even get things rolling to get through over to the other body. But I think everybody who works at the Capitol and follows this watches this little game every year or two, and it becomes a political football while the taxpayers are the ones just sort of waiting for us to all get our work done. So I really appreciate you allowing me to have the conversation with you and the committee taking the time to hear about it. And House File 318, members, this really is something we have to do. So I appreciate Representative Davids, you carrying this, because this is tax relief our citizens are waiting for. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for putting the A6 and A7 amendment out there for discussion. We will study that and visit about that. So I'd just like to thank you and the committee for their time.
Thank you. With that, we're in layover. Representative Davids, House Bill 318 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Would someone like to move Representative Clark's bill? Is she here? I've seen her. Here she is. Come on. She's come in and out. Representative Paymar would like to move Representative Clark's House file. Do you have the number?
885
for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And you know, I should say, members, I've had a number of people ask me about voting on this today. As you know, we're not voting on this as most bills. And Representative Clark introduced the non-tax provisions as a separate bill. and then that committee can hear those. We're just going to keep this bill right here. We had some confusion on the floor, and she withdrew her motion so that we could just hear it here, and they can hear it there, and then the tax committee can decide what it wants to do with the alcohol tax issue later in the year, whether or not we want it in the omnibus tax bill or not. So, Representative Clark, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for hearing this bill. And members, there are two amendments that I'd like to have you put on so that we could get it in the order that...
So Representative Amar moves the A1 amendment. Discussion. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed say nay. Motion carries. And now Representative Amar moves the A2.
A6
or A2? And Representative Paymar now moves the A2 to get the bill in the form the author would like it. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The A2 is adopted. So now, Representative Clark, is that it? Do you have the bill the way you want to talk about it today?
Thank you.
Okay. Yes.
Yes.
Sorry. Do you want to go back?
No, we don't need to.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Garofalo. And, you know, members, I apologize if I just went through that. You know, we generally have let all authors just put their author's amendments on and talk about them the way they intend them to be. So, are you okay, Representative Garofalo? Okay. Thank you. Representative Clark, please, your bill as amended.
Okay. Madam Chair, so this bill is a bill that would increase the taxes on liquor, on wine and beer. And it's described here in the amendments. I think we make it pretty clear. And you're getting a document that tells you what this bill actually, in the end, will do. We're trying to address a problem of alcohol tax right now not paying anything like the cost to the society that we have. We're talking about public safety costs, health care costs, costs that relate to everything from prison costs to what it costs for a person to go through chemical dependency treatment. And as you get these folders, and I think if we're running short, we have some more that are coming in. Did everybody get one? Okay. We're talking about raising about $200 million and saving about $1 billion with the proposal that we have before you. $1 billion related to alcohol costs. And as I mentioned, it's a whole realm of things. You can look at the bill. It deals with law enforcement costs, everything from DWI accidents to costs to the courts, going through the diversion programs, treatment, and making sure that we have programs in place that help people with their chemical dependency. It includes everything from the costs that are related to child protection, to sober high schools and colleges, the health and human services costs. And the document you have goes through the return on the investment, and you can see that it's very substantial. I'm going to ask to have some witnesses testify, Madam Chair, who will go through some of this.
Please.
And then you'll be able to look at it. And if you have questions, I think hopefully these documents will help you. Just look at the cover page for one thing, though, to get something really clear. What we're talking about with this particular bill is that we are increasing the cost per drink on a beer 3.5 cents, the cost per drink on wine about 9 cents, and the cost per drink on hard liquor $1. That's what results in about a $200 million, it's actually $190 million, I believe, increase in revenue. And as I mentioned, that's up against a cost of at least $1 billion, maybe I heard numbers 1.4, 1.6 that were being cost by alcohol costs. So I'm going to start with, let's see, Carol Falkowski. I'll ask her to come down first.
Please. Please, welcome. And we may want another chair if the pages can pull one over so more of Representative Clark's testifiers can join us. Oh, you stay right there, madam. We would love to hear from you.
Okay.
Give us your testimony. We just want to queue up someone else with you.
Oh,
okay. Well, we like you. That was all about getting a better chair. I get it. Okay. Thank you. Please.
What did I do to
it? All right. Thank you very much. My name is Carol Falkowski. I am here today representing Drug Abuse Dialogues, which is an educational organization that I founded after I retired from 25 years in state government last fall. And the last 2 years, I was director of the State Alcohol and Drug Abuse Agency at the Department of Human Services, and for the past 2 years was working with other state agencies to develop Minnesota's first ever state substance abuse strategy. This was based on the idea that it's been estimated that any state's budget, about 15% of any state's budget, comes from the costs associated with drug and alcohol abuse, although it doesn't appear as a line item in any particular or any particular state agency. But overall, that is the estimate. So realizing that there would be responding to this multifaceted far reach of substance abuse extends beyond the purview of any single state agency, I worked with multiple state agencies over the course of the last 2 years to come up with a state, Minnesota's first ever state substance abuse strategy. It's estimated in Minnesota that the annual cost of alcohol use alone is over $5 billion. And this cost is 17 times greater than the amount that tax revenue is that's collected from the sale of alcohol. This state strategy, and I'm just going to talk briefly about it, outlines a blueprint for the future so that no matter what else state agencies are doing about drug and alcohol abuse, they can do what is contained in this strategy. And along those lines, about strengthening prevention efforts within and across communities and preventing substance abuse before it happens, it recommends to increase efforts to enact statewide policies to reduce underage drinking by evaluating the appropriate level of alcohol excise tax, and that's what this bill has done. Numerous studies indicate that raising alcohol taxes are an effective method of deterring and reducing youth alcohol use, of reducing alcohol-related motor vehicle accident mortality and morbidity, and reducing other collateral consequences associated with excessive drinking, including alcohol-related violence. It reduces demand and consumption, and consequently the carnage and the costs related to drinking. Now, in some states, alcohol taxes flow into the state's general revenue funds. However, some states have earmarked alcohol tax revenue specifically to combat alcohol problems through treatment, prevention, and law enforcement. Other states earmark part or all of the revenue for programs such as alcohol research, alcohol beverage control offices, local government, state building construction, pension relief, transportation, and ironically, the state grape industry. Arkansas, Ohio, Oregon, and Washington use the tax revenue for that. An alcohol excise tax increase in New Mexico generated about $15 million annually in new revenue. About a third of this went toward alcohol prevention and treatment activities at the local level. Arizona earmarks more than a third of its liquor tax revenue for state corrections funds. Approximately the same percentage of Michigan's revenue from liquor taxes go to convention promotion and an equal share dedicated to school aid. Idaho, Nevada, New Jersey, Ohio, and Texas are among the states that provide a portion of alcohol revenues for alcohol education and prevention programs. So again, the idea of having dedicated funds that are dedicated purposes as that are funded by alcohol tax is not unprecedented. Again, I just want to reiterate that the costs of alcohol exceed by far the tax revenue, and just let you know that this is sound public policy that other states have used to offset the public costs attributable to alcohol use, which are quite wide and dispersed among all levels of government here as well as in every state.
Thank you so much. And Representative Clark, if we can go through all your testifiers before we take questions, sure. If folks can stay around, I think that'd be easier. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Next, I'd like to ask Oda Zanders to come forward.
Please. Maybe you want to have a... Yeah,
we have a
that'd
couple people
great.
Up here?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
That's
and
great.
And following that, Lieutenant Hildreth.
Great. Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Oda Zanders. I certainly serve as the CEO at UJAMA Place. UJAMA is a small nonprofit organization that serves, that provides reentry as well as transformation service for young African American men between 18 and 30 years old. Prior to taking on this job, I served 35 years with the state of Minnesota in the one agency, Department of Corrections. During my 35 years with Corrections, I worked approximately 15 years with juvenile offenders at Red Wing and the other 20 with adult offenders at various adult facilities. During my 35 years with the agency, we experienced unprecedented growth in our prison population. Our stats will show you that alcohol and drug abuse were major contributors to this unprecedented increase in our prison population. The numerous things that were done prior as well as post-incarceration. During that stay, the prison system implemented several drug treatment programs. We have stats to show you that there was significant decrease in our recidivism in terms of reincarceration as well as reconviction for those that got treated. Unfortunately, only one-third of Minnesota inmates received treatment. So we're releasing two-thirds that didn't receive this treatment. This bill is proposing diversion of funds for prior incarceration and post-incarceration we truly support. During my time that I spent after retirement to serve in several nonprofit organizations like UJAMA that provide these services to prevent some of the issues that we have, especially with our youth. We well know that alcohol as well as drug is gateway or segues to crime in our community and all the medical effect that it has as well. We're talking about an unacceptable behavior that these drugs and alcohol do provide for underage as well as on the health care agency that we know of. In our program, I think it's important that we have issues in our community to address these at the grassroots level. They talk about the actually provincial level. We understand that in this state, there should be a last resort, but unfortunately, services are needed. The money is needed to provide this. I think this inevitable, this diversion program will provide not only treatment, but it would enhance our education delivery. Programs such as UJAMA, we provide those kind of relapse prevention programs, as well as education attainment, housing assistance, employment assistance, family reunification, as well as trying to prevent contact with the penal system. We truly feel that this investment will allow Minnesota to have an immediate return on its investment. The cost of treatment varies from $7,000 to $15,000 per person, opposed to average of maybe $38,000 that's in our prison system. So immediately we will see a benefit not only our society but the welfare of people that remain out as law-abiding citizens as well as taxpayers. So a program like you, Gemma, and to be able to see this bill introduced, we very much support it and hope that attention be given to pre-diversion as well as prison release programs to capture the elements of this deadly disease.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Lieutenant Chris Hildreth. I'm a commander from the Minneapolis Police Department, and I've been invited by the representative and our government affairs people to address your committee about House File 885. My agency is one of the largest in the state. I oversee in my capacity 800 licensed liquor establishments, and the effects of alcohol in the city of Minneapolis are significant. I want to highlight two events that happened in the very recent past that are probably things that all of you have seen on TV and in the news, and give you a little bit of financial highlights from that. Last year, a licensed liquor establishment held an event that was actually outside of legal guidelines. Youth attended, alcohol was consumed, and as typical in my 30 years of law enforcement, alcohol reduces people's ability to think straight, and the result was some fights that started to brew in a crowd. Ultimately, the police department was called to this establishment. Four people were shot. Three of those were innocent bystanders, and the labor cost just for the police department for that one incident on that night was $15,000. I did not tabulate the cost of the hospital stays. Three of those people were in intensive care for quite a long time, and the costs are significant. Several of those people were indigent people, so those costs were taken up by the state to pay for those medical costs. Another incident occurred several years ago when youth that were fueled by alcohol were celebrating the event of the Gopher hockey team winning a game. and it turned into a large-scale riot. I had hundreds of thousands of dollars in damage in the Dinkytown Entertainment District area, in many of my licensed establishments. I had many students that were hurt. I had police officers that were hurt. We had several hundred police officers from multiple jurisdictions respond. I don't have the dollar cost figure for that, but I can tell you that it was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And the lawsuits that ensued after that event were significant. My agency does, on a regular basis, weekly, undercover stings for alcohol compliance with licensed liquor establishments. We also investigate incidents of illegal alcohol sales in tippling houses, as well as party incidents where people are illegally drinking and are underage. My agency's been the recipient of dollars from this fund that's before you to take dollars from these tax dollars, put it into special funds, and grants are given to law enforcement. I sat here through your tax hearing earlier, and you understand as well as I do that the federal government has cut a lot of things and forced a lot of stuff to the states. The result of that is that there's less and less money for law enforcement to do our jobs. Local government aid cuts to the city of Minneapolis have significantly impacted us. I used to have an agency doing this work of 13 people. With budget cuts, I'm down to 5 people to do this type of thing. I rely on grants to help do some of this undercover work, to pay people. I recruit decoys that are people that are typically in law enforcement programs, and we try to use this as a tool to recruit people and get them to be police officers. I've had to share these grants with many other law enforcement agencies over the years, and I don't any longer get the grants because there's not enough money in the fund anymore. Other agencies get to take a turn getting that money. So though I'm the largest agency in the state, with 800 establishments selling alcohol, we're one of the largest tax generators in the state through our entertainment districts. The funds are less and less each year, and passing a bill such as this that puts more money in there helps the state. Fire departments years ago learned that if you do prevention, you'll have a lot less deaths, you'll have a lot less fires, and it's the same way in law enforcement. Those grants allow us to do preventative things. I work cooperatively with the University of Minnesota to study alcohol and violence-related incidents, and we try to work smarter. I also work with the other member that testified here today, Carol Falkowski, getting grants from the agencies at the state to do preventative things. The last thing I would like to leave you with is that this isn't just about money, it's about people's lives. As I had testified about one of the incidents where 4 people are shot, daily in my 30 years of law enforcement, I deal with a lot of death. From 2009 to 2011, there were 344 deaths just related to DWIs in this state. For pedestrian deaths related to alcohol, there were 117 deaths and 275 serious injuries. With motorcyclists involved with alcohol, there have been 140 deaths since 2009 and 584 serious injuries. That's just the people that died, and it is an incredible toll, emotional toll on the people, the citizens of the state that are left behind after those people die. Alcohol in licensed establishments and elsewhere has a huge impact on people. It kills a lot of people, and it affects a lot of lives. And my comrade here from the prison system, I would echo his comments. I did a search right before I came here, and the categories of crime that we see in Minneapolis, every single category of crime from small to large is affected and has alcohol or drugs involved. Over 75% of the people that we arrest have alcohol or drugs as an issue involved in the case. It's a serious thing, and greater funding is needed, and the passage of this bill to increase that funding would greatly help us.
Thank you, Lieutenant Hildreth. Thank you for being here. The next testifier, please. And I, Representative Clark, We also have folks who want to speak against the bill, too, and sure, questions. So I don't know how many more people you have. I guess I just saw. Okay. So they might want to all come down. Might be easier, more of them. So is it? I have four names still. Is that right?
Well,
or five?
That are left, you mean?
Yes.
One, two, looks like four, five. Yes.
Yes, please. So maybe everyone can kind of tighten it up a little bit. We have to adjourn it, too. So please, welcome.
Madam Chair, thank you. Members of the committee, my name is Dan Kane. I'm the president of a social service agency that provides substance abuse treatment, correctional services, electronic monitoring, drug testing, housing, among other services. I'm here to testify in favor of House File 885. There are many reasons to pass this bill, which I'll go into some of them, but for me, the question is, why wasn't this done before, and why is it so modest? Taxes are the state's way of paying for services. And in the case of alcohol, studies suggest that nearly 80% of the alcohol that's consumed is done by some 20% or less of the people that drink. So if we were to use creative linguistics, as we have in the past, we could argue that this isn't a tax at all, but prepayment for treatment and the other services used or necessitated by the abuse of alcohol. In fact, if we were to measure the societal, individual, and collateral damage from alcohol abuse against the impact of other drugs which are illegal, we'd probably outlaw its use altogether, which we all know isn't going to happen. Minnesota, up until some two decades ago, was the nation's leader in treatment for addiction. Originally under Governor Carlson, that began to change and has continued ever since. In 1991, treatment rates were frozen for 2 years in an attempt to aid in balancing the state budget. They were frozen again under the previous governor, and many programs have never recovered. Prior to that, and again in an attempt to control costs, authorized lengths of stay, both in inpatient and outpatient programs, was curtailed, and dollars previously directed to treatment were siphoned off to pay for a largely ineffective assessment process that was only repaired in the last 5 years. Treatment access was further eroded when Tier 2 of the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund was eliminated. That provision provided access to treatment for the working poor. And now with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare as many people like to call it, much of treatment reimbursement will be shifted to Medicaid, which doesn't pay for residential services. Any effort to preserve and enhance access to and payment for these services is crucial. Now, the entertainment and beverage alcohol industry will lobby against this bill, arguing that they can't absorb the costs and jobs will be lost. A closer look will reveal that alcohol sales, and compared to other commodities, have enjoyed a ridiculously low inflation rate. For example, when I stopped drinking in 1968, and I realize several of you probably weren't even born then, a 24-unit case of beer went for around $4. Today, that same case of beer, depending on brand, goes for between $14 and $20. There are certainly exceptions for craft beers and some of the other specialty lagers, but compared to other commodities, gasoline in 1968 cost 30 cents a gallon. Bread was a quarter. A candy bar was 10 cents. A bottle of soda was 10 cents with a 3-cent deposit for the bottle. The argument for cost in comparison to the inflation on all other commodities is ridiculous. Also in 1968, a pack of cigarettes was 29 cents, and that was for Marlboros, not for some off-brand. Today, that pack of cigarettes can cost as much as $5. Unlike some other products, the increase in cigarette prices was due to significantly increased taxes, considerably larger than the increases that are being proposed today. The result is many of us who smoked in 1968 don't do so in 2013. And more importantly, far fewer young people start to smoke at all. And most among us consider that to be a good thing. The impact on behavior, poverty, illness, employment, and family stability is much less negatively impacted by smoking than by alcohol use. And smoking does not lower inhibitions to the point where people would hurt innocent bystanders in automobiles or increase compulsive behavior to the point of family violence and other bad decisions. As I said when I began, the concern is my concern is that it hasn't been passed before, and it's been watered down to the point where the price point will not likely have the same deterrent effect the increased cost of cigarettes did. Nor will it truly add enough to the resources needed to adequately shovel up from the fallout of alcohol abuse. But the last time the alcohol tax was raised was 35 years ago in 1978. So if history repeats itself and it takes that long to do it again, it may make sense to raise the bar even higher, or at least index for inflation. In my estimation, there are only three reasons to vote against this bill. One, you're opposed to any new taxes. But as I said, if you want to categorize this as a fee, which has been done before, the argument is stronger here than in some other areas where that jargon has been used in the past. Two, the beverage alcohol industry may reduce their contribution to campaign chests. And three, alcohol is a drug of choice for many powerful people, some of whom may be in this room. It's a drug whose impact on society should be offset by the people who use it the most. And this is a way to do that and pay for needed services. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Kane. Are you Mr. Hurley or Mr. Meshick by chance?
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I know you want to get through the testifiers, but there was but there's a point there that I think needs to be addressed. There are members of this chamber on a bipartisan basis who are opposed to this proposal. And it has nothing to do with the amount of campaign contributions that are going into their coffers. Advice for future testifiers coming up in questioning the motives of members on a bipartisan basis, that somehow our votes are steered, that my opposition to a huge tax increase in alcohol or members on the other side of the aisle who are also opposed to this tax increase are somehow tied to the fact that we have contributions going to our campaign. It's insulting, and more importantly, it's an ineffective lobbying technique to sway members of this body. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Are you, and I didn't hear that, Representative Garofalo,
oh,
so,
did,
okay. Okay.
Heard it, Madam Chair.
Are you Mr. Hurley or Mr. Meshick?
Not either, but I'm on a list, Madam Chair.
Okay, please, and we're going to run out of time, so if people can make their comments a little shorter, because we got to let the opponents talk, too.
Thank
Welcome.
You. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I intended to do that. My name is Calvin Sari. I'm the legislative liaison for the Minnesota Corrections Association.
Oh, okay.
We are the largest of the many correctional organizations that there are in the state. And MCA is one of the organizations that has had this particular bill on its legislative agenda for many, many years. And every time this bill has come forward, we have been here to support that effort. I'm not going to give you a lot of statistics as the others have. I know time is short. We simply wanted to go on record is that we are in total support of this legislation. Obviously, our people representing probation officers, correctional administrators, the program vendors from throughout the state are obviously impacted by the need for funding to provide good correctional, sound correctional programming in the state of Minnesota. And we thank Representative Clark for bringing this bill forward, and we urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sori, I think is how you pronounce it, and I appreciate you being here. Others, please come forward. Please, you can just start talking, ma'am. You've got the microphone. Go right ahead while they figure out what's going on behind you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chairperson and members of this committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of this proposed bill creating an Alcohol Health and Judicial Impact Fund. My name is Nell Hurley. I'm the director of Minnesota Recovery Connection, and I'm also a person in long-term recovery, which for me means that I have not used drugs or alcohol for over 15 years. I know that the issue at hand here is money and taxes, and I understand that you have the very difficult job of creating viable and agreed-upon solutions to deal with the deficit we face in our state. But I wanted to come before you today to remind you what happens when we allow for prevention, treatment, and recovery support, all things that could be made possible through the provision of an alcohol tax. What happens is what happened to me. I was very sick as a young person in my 20s, but because I was treated for my illness, I went from someone who took resources from society through hospital visits, involvement in the criminal justice system, missed days at work, even property damage, to a person who got well My recovery started with treatment many years ago and continues on a daily basis all these years later. What's important to recognize is that since being in recovery, I have not once visited a hospital emergency room. I have not compromised the safety of myself or others by driving drunk. I've not provided drugs to others or alcohol to minors. I've not been arrested. I've not been incarcerated. I've not lost my faculties or my rights, and I've not missed a single day of work due to a hangover. Instead, I obtained a master's degree on a full scholarship from the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul. I quit smoking and became a five-time marathon finisher. I'm a full-time productive employee for a local nonprofit organization, and I'm three-quarters of the way through my second graduate program, this time at Hamline University in St. Paul, where I'm earning a master's degree in nonprofit management. I vote, I pay taxes, I contribute to Social Security. I'm an engaged, attentive, loving mother to my 8-year-old son, Jasper, who's never once seen me under the influence or hungover. I'm almost done. So what does my story have to do with the alcohol tax? Well, a lot, actually. I was an underage drinker during high school. I graduated in 1987, which is the last year that the alcohol tax was raised. I think Dan Kane said it was 1978, but it was 1987, the year that I graduated from high school. When I was in high school, a cup at a keg party was $2. Well, I did my research this past week, and I was told by current high school students at the same high school that I went to in St. Paul that the cost of a cup at a keg party today is, quote, about $3. Raising taxes on alcohol is an effective form of prevention. It is a deterrent, a lesson we've learned with tobacco. Raising the long overdue alcohol tax could also generate revenue to provide treatment and recovery support for consumers who need help, people like me. And raising the tax would, as has already been pointed out, shift the financial burden to the heaviest consumers who cost the most money to society, so it brings with it accountability. It is simply bad policy to ignore a viable opportunity to address the most serious health problem affecting all taxpayers in this state. It is also unconscionable to ignore the fact that the alcohol lobby has not acted in the best interest of all citizens by blocking previous efforts to modestly raise taxes on the use of a substance that causes so many problems that all of us end up paying for anyway. I urge this committee to give this bill due consideration and to consider using some of the funds generated from a tax increase on alcohol to address issues related to alcoholism, such as covering costs for treatment, detox, recovery high schools, and other costs related to the continuum of care.
Thank you for your testimony. Others, please, if you could join us. We really don't want to have two hearings on this, folks, so we're going to have to kind of move it along, and we're going to have two hearings on this.
Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, and esteemed representatives, thank you so much for inviting us to be here. And my name is Scott Washburn, and I am the assistant director of the Step Up program at Augsburg College, and we are very privileged to have the largest recovery community of college students living together on a college campus in the country, right here in Minnesota. We have over 80 students who are in recovery from alcohol and drug addiction, who are going to school, who are staying sober, who are finding ways to be successful, and I brought one with me who is going to testify together with me. But real quickly, briefly, my background is I have over 25 years experience as a clinician working with adolescents, specializing in substance abuse and mental health disorders. I've worked for the Hazelden Foundation for a number of years. I've worked for mental health agencies. I also spent nearly a decade working at Minnetonka High School in the West Metro as their chemical health person. So I've done treatment, inpatient, outpatient, prevention, early intervention, the whole continuum throughout my career. And what I'm here to say, folks, is a couple of things briefly. Number one, the reality of underage drinking is it continues to be with us, and it continues to be a very real risk that I think we need to pay attention to. Because we know from the research from the Minnesota Student Survey that 40% of 12th graders report drinking in the last 30 days. We also know that almost, looks like 24% of 12th graders are binge drinking. And why is that a concern? Well, we know adolescents respond differently to alcohol. They're at higher risk, the brain responds differently, you know. Consequently, a lot can happen that way. But what I want to highlight is the efficacy, the effectiveness of treatment. What we know from research is that adolescents who go to treatment, get help, and complete that treatment, they actually do well. They actually recover. But what we know about adolescents is they require more than just a 28-day focused treatment. They require a strong, supportive system of aftercare, and recovery schools is one of the ways to do it. What we see at Augsburg in our program with Texas Tech, who has a collegiate recovery program, see over 90% of our students stay sober. Over 90%. That is huge, huge. And so I want to give some time to Mr. Chadwick so that he can share some of his
Thank
own
you.
Personal testimony.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Chadwick.
Thank you. My name is James Chadwick, and I'm a senior psychology student at Augsburg College, and I'm a member of the Step Up program, and I'm an alcoholic. And alcoholism is a disease, just like cancer or diabetes. It doesn't get a lot of the same treatment because of some of the stigma and, you know, moral implications. But it is a disease, and I'm here to, you know, attest to the fact that I could not have gotten sober and stayed in recovery. I just celebrated 18 months on Valentine's Day without the help of state-run programs. I went to treatment twice. I'm, as I said, a member of the Step Up program, and I now intern at Alliance Academy Sober High School, where I get to work with other kids in recovery, and that, to me, is hugely rewarding. So I used to be a drain on society. I used to be part of a lot of the costs to the government, but now I feel that I'm contributing. And I don't think I could do that without help from other programs. So this is really important to me, and thanks for your time.
Thank you for being here, Mr. Chadwick, and congratulations to you that you. Things are working out for you now. We have Ms.
Just about
yes?
Done. Just about done. I think we have, I'm going to ask these two. I think this is our last two.
Okay.
Well, they've asked to be brief, and they're going to okay. give more of their written testimony, so it'll be a condensed
version. And we'd like you to all stay because we want the opponents to speak, too, and then we can ask everyone questions. So welcome. Are you Ms. Lunt, by
yeah.
chance? Yes, please.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Teresa Lunt. I'm an Osseo Area School Board member, and I'm also the community chair of Partnership for Change, a local coalition of youth, parents, schools, and community groups that are working together to reduce drug use among youth and young adults in Northwest Hennepin County. The coalition's focus is changing the community environment that leads to youth substance use by identifying and implementing strategies that will affect and change community attitudes, perceptions, norms, and beliefs around alcohol and other drugs. Partnership for Change was organized in 2008 after staff members from the trauma department at North Memorial Medical Center noticed an alarming trend in the number of young patients being seen at the hospital with alcohol-related injuries. The number of patients was increasing, and their average blood alcohol content level was 0.12. By being a part of this coalition, I've learned there's a comprehensive approach to changing the environment that leads to underage alcohol use. Schools and parents can do their parts to protect our children from the dangers of underage alcohol use, but there is more that can be done. And as legislators, you can have a powerful impact on youth access to alcohol. You've heard from others the research that shows alcohol excise tax increases reduce consumption by problem drinkers, and most importantly, by our youth. Another thing that I would like to bring to your attention is that schools bear a brunt of the academic, social, and economic consequences of student use. Most of these costs fall back on local and economic consequences of student use. Most of these costs fall back on local city and county governments and school districts. We've learned that while combating tobacco use, youth are price sensitive, and increasing the excise tax will reduce use. As a parent of two children and a school board member with a district of over 20,000 students, I believe it's imperative that we all do our part to keep our children safe and healthy, and I ask you to support House File 885 to increase in the alcohol excise tax so that you will do your collective part to reduce underage alcohol use. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lunt. Appreciate you being here. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chairperson and members of this committee. My name is Charlie Mischick. Thank you for the opportunity to allow me to speak on the proposed bill creating an Alcohol Health and Judicial Impact Fund. I'm here as a member of the Minnesota Association of Resources for Recovery and Chemical Health, which is known as MARCH. an organization that represents the substance abuse providers in the state. You've already heard from other speakers that this idea of a user fee or an alcohol excise tax has been advanced before and, in fact, even passed by the legislature and only to be vetoed by the governor. And also you've heard that about 20% of drinkers consume about 85% of all alcoholic beverages. And the proposed increase of this tax would generate $186 million to pay for criminal justice, law enforcement, treatment, detox services, and prevention. The 80% of Minnesotans who drink relatively little would not be appreciably affected. Currently, the economic burden of alcohol use in Minnesota includes costs for public safety, medical treatment, law enforcement, fire and emergency response. You've heard some of this before, but most of these costs fall on cities and counties and are paid through property tax revenues. The costs of detoxification services are specifically excluded from the same funds that pay for other types of chemical dependency treatment, and this has been a burden that the counties bear. If they could get some relief from this, I'm sure the monies that are now devoted to covering detox could be used for other services within each county. Since much of the focus of this session of the legislature is focused on taxes, and many creative suggestions have been put forward, I urge this committee to give this bill due consideration. I benefited from exposure to treatment many years ago myself, and I've been a law-abiding, tax-paying voter for many years. I know that in our current economic climate, with the looming shadow of sequestration on the horizon, it seems prudent to me that a small increase in the excise taxes for the sale of alcohol would not only create a small reduction in our annual budget deficit, possibly allow for some property tax relief for the counties, and most importantly, provide, at least in part, funds that could be used to deal with the problems that the abuse of alcohol causes all of us. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks, everybody. I know there's others who want to be or want to demonstrate support. And thank you, Representative Clark. Maybe we'll be able to get them in if we hear from the other side for a little bit. Folks who have concerns about Representative Clark's bill, please come forward. Did anybody want to testify in opposition? In opposition? Yes, please. Go right ahead. There's a bunch behind you. So,
okay, start. I guess I've got to kind of lean over here. Madam Chair, committee, thank you very much for allowing me to speak to you today about this taxation issue. My name is John Falconer. I'm the owner and operator of Falconer Vineyards Winery and Nursery in Minnesota, Red Wing, Minnesota. And what I want to talk about is what this can do to our industry. We're producers, and we're small. Minnesota farm wine industry is still fairly small, but growing, and it would certainly destroy our growth. I was the 13th winery 10 years ago. There are 66 now. There are between 800 and 900 grape growers in Minnesota. Other than ethanol, it's one of the top expanding agricultural businesses or industries in the state. Kind of under the radar, but it's really expanding. By having an addition in excise tax is the wrong way to handle these issues. The people testifying, I certainly laud them for what they are doing, for what they're working on. It must be very hard working in those fields. And it's a big societal problem. But by doing it through an excise tax on producers, it'll end up lowering what your tax intake will be, because we'll just have to stop making a lot of things. So where's your gain? The tax proposed, like on our Frontenac Port, which won the first annual Minnesota's Governor's Cup, it's been an international gold medal winner. Yes, we can compete on the international marketplace. The proposed increase in tax on that would be equal to $3 a bottle. Well, I can tell you, that kills my sales outside Minnesota. I mean, if you're taxing all of them in Minnesota, that's fine, but I'm not going to be able to sell it to another state. I'm not going to be able to export it. It really, excise taxes damage manufacturers no matter what field you're in. They were started primarily hundred years ago when there weren't that many industries that could develop a tax. And they stayed on the books. The way to do a tax like that is find another method. And I would propose one, and everybody would probably go, ah, yuck, you know. But right now we already paid, we have to collect 9.375% sales tax when we sell. So already extra money from the sale of that goes to wherever the state wants to use it, whether it wants to use it for these purposes that we've been hearing or others. Certainly that would be an avenue. It would be more, it would be definitely a larger reach. But doing it through two producers and an industry that the state has supported growth in, they've funded the development for 30-some years and developing cold, hardy, winter-hardy grapes that are high quality. They're grown throughout the world now. Even China's putting in thousands and thousands of acres of them. So let's not stop an industry. Let's not kill one of our new growth agricultural industries.
Thank you, Mr. Faulkner. Mr. Bagnoli, please.
Madam Chair, if members of the committee, Joe Bagnoli, on behalf of the Minnesota Licensed Beverage, if I might, there's eight people that were going to testify here. You have about 8 minutes. We have at least one person from out of town. I would defer to him if we're going to come back. Are we?
You know, we'll see how far we go. Let's just keep going for now and see where we get to. We want to be fair in this, so... Please, there's someone in the chair, so who's ever in the chair, please start talking. And meanwhile, you can figure out the next person.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Edward Reynoso. Yes. I'm political director for Teamsters Joint Council 32.
Thank you.
I, you know, I'm going to be as quick as I can with this. I commend you for the great job that this committee did last night. 5 hours of testimony was phenomenal, and you guys did a phenomenal job. But I just want to warn you, we're really going to test you on this one, because I heard there's 90 people signed up to also testify for the tax for the governor's budget.
Right.
We've actually convinced them all to testify in opposition to this bill, and they're right outside.
They're all in the hallway.
They're all outside in the hallway.
Well, we'll definitely give you a second hearing if there's 90 people out there. Please.
So, nonetheless, we represent 62,000 members in the state of Minnesota, active and retired Teamsters in the state of Minnesota. We represent over 1,000 members, specifically in the liquor industry. I got to tell you, though, across the country, we represent over 50,000 workers just in the beer industry and the liquor industry. In many cases, we make the beer, we transport the beer, we warehouse the beer, and then we deliver it to these stores. And in some cases, we actually represent Teamsters and municipal liquor stores. So as you can expect, we have a lot of members in the liquor industry. You know, early on, let me preface by saying I highly respect Representative Clark, and I consider her a great friend. We had early conversation about this bill, and I never say no to a bill prior to seeing it. I think it's to formulate an opinion on a bill, you have to see it. But I got to tell you, once I've seen the bill, there's no way and no manner in which we could support this bill in the manner it's written now. The spirit of the bill, I want to preface also by saying, our organization by no means is opposed to addressing the misuse and abuse of alcohol. We believe it's a good thing to address, but we believe it needs to be a conversation amongst the industry, the stakeholders, the advocacy groups, and labor to find a resolve on ways to address the problem in this society with misuse and abuse of alcohol. Our concern, main concern, is the fact that this is a potential loss of jobs. We've seen in the past when in other states and across this country when taxes have been raised on liquor products, the loss of revenue that these employers had, the loss of products sold, which in turn created the loss of permanently lost jobs. That's one of our main concerns. The impact of this bill in the current form in which it's written, we feel could potentially lose those jobs. We support the initiative, the idea of coming forward and addressing these issues. But again, we offer opposition to the bill and the way it's written for the potential loss of jobs. Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
We want to hear from the, just a moment, from the last person who's going to be, who's from out of town. We are going to continue the hearing because it's just not fair to have not everyone get heard. So we're going to take your testimony. Can we just see a show of hands of folks who still want to testify in opposition to the bill? Okay. Quite a few, and let us, you know, we'll get your names and stuff after. Were there others who wanted to testify for the bill that felt that like they were getting hurried up and had more to say? Okay, so we'll want to come back. We're looking right now at March 6th or 7th is kind of how we think it might be. Representative Clark has sent me a note, and I've asked her. I think we're going to have another hearing, as Mr. Bagnoli was mentioning. So if that's all right, we'd like to take your testimony because you won't be back. And then we'll continue this hearing, and then members can ask all kinds of questions. And I guess you won't be here, but Mr. Bagnoli, I'm sure, can cover for you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Anderson.
I actually have a question for the last testifier, and I'm just worried that, you know, as we continue this down the road, I won't have an opportunity to ask him. It's just a quick clarification that if he can get me the information later on, that would be helpful.
Okay, sure. If you want to just say it into the microphone, then we can get it, because this gentleman has to leave.
Yeah, I'm just, if you can get me some information on the tax increase that we have here, how many jobs you would be able to have under that tax increase amount, how many jobs equals that amount. If you could get that to me via email, that'd be great. And
thank you.
We'll certainly look to supply you that. I know we have, this gentleman is actually, I believe, is going to talk on behalf of the last time there was a big increase in taxes, how many jobs that actually cost the industry itself. So it's
okay.
Probably some information.
So we're going to get an answer right now. Welcome, okay. Please.
Thanks. My name's Ted Powers with Anheuser-Busch, and I wanted to just touch on the regressivity, but I'll mention the job loss. DRI McGraw-Hill, the econometric firm, did a study when federal beer excise tax was doubled in 1991, and that did result in about 30,000 lost jobs, a little more than that, but that was the econometric analysis at that time. I wanted to touch on regressivity as well, because a study analyzing the Consumer Expenditure Survey of the Bureau of Labor Statistics finds that roughly half of the beer is purchased by families with incomes less than $50,000. So clearly a regressive tax, and the job losses as well. And the only other point that I'll make, and I'll be brief, while we oppose the higher taxes, we do brew our beers to be enjoyed responsibly by adults. And for the past 30 years, Anheuser-Busch has been a leader in promoting alcohol responsibility. And since 1982, when our first responsible drinking campaign came out, No When to Say When, Anheuser-Busch and our wholesalers have spent about $930 million in national advertising and community-based programs to prevent underage drinking and drunk driving. So, and I did appreciate the Teamster testimony. All our breweries are Teamsters. They brew it, they package it, they warehouse it, and they deliver it. So very much appreciate that as well. So thanks for the time. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. And thanks for everybody for your understanding. I'm sorry we just couldn't get it all in by the end. That was probably mostly my fault because we talked about federal conformity too long. So I apologize. We're going to adjourn, and we'll let you know as soon as we can. We'll try to get the continuation scheduled. We're adjourned. Thank you.